Testing. Testing 1, 2. This is January 16th, 1984, and we're in Manly Hot Springs at our home talking with Stanley Deo.
In Mount Baker?
Yeah. Mount Baker National Forest, that's in Louisiana. Yeah.
And there's different camps around there.
Well, that was during the, when we were cutting that road, you know, that was the toughest part of the depression. And just like I stated there, working for, that was under the state of Washington. You couldn't pay less than $4 a day. But then there was all kinds of logging, these Jiffo logs here and there, you know, when they got a job. They were paying, some of them was only paying $2 a day, $2.50 a day. And they were, a lot of them would be working by the piece, you know what I mean, a thousand. Mm-hmm. If you was working by the thousand, you made $2.50, $3 a day. You was working too. And that's what the cross cuts, we call the misery whips, you know, when you're is.
But then you're living in town. And
yeah, I was living in, the reason they had a camp out there, the only reason they didn't have no camp wasn't big enough, and a bunch of us home guards, we'd come back down the road, drive into town. They had cars, you know, Model A's and that, you know.
But then, what did you do once you got back to town? I mean,
well, that's where we lived. I was living home, you know. Me and my brother had this place.
Well, I can't imagine a guy working in the woods all day and then going back and staying at home. You probably took off somewhere.
Oh, well, there was entertainment. They had dances, you know, and stuff like that around. It was just a hick town. That's all. There was a school and a couple of boarding houses that these loggers used to stay in, and bootleggers around there. That was during prohibition, you know. Oh, you go different, all kinds of, you know, you had friends, you'd go over and goof around, you know.
There's no other camps around there that you go visit or anything?
Huh?
There's no other camps around there you'd go visit or?
Oh, no. There was plenty of places, you know, around them, what we call them all stump ranchers, you know. They had all this all logged over land, and we call them stump ranchers. Because they were planting between the stumps, and they'd pull stumps, you know, and clearing land, and that was the own name, you know, stump ranchers, because they had more stumps than anything else. Well, you couldn't sell nothing there. You couldn't give it away. You just raise enough stuff for yourself. And you could raise just about, like I say there, you could raise just about anything. You know, line truck stuff, you know, and then there's a lot of deer in the hill, and everybody's poaching them, of course, you know. People had livestock too, you know, like you say, pigs and steers, and that, and knock one out of head if they needed it, and chickens. And
Yvonne, was that the same time that?
I think what you're talking about, you're trying to figure out how it was he worked all day and never got any sleep at night when you were going to visit that other
camp. Oh, well, that'd be, we'd go and visit the, we'd go around to some place, they'd have some kind of a little party going on, you know, chasing girls, you know. That would be. And we'd work all day, and then about 12, 1 o'clock, 2 at night, come home, get a couple hours of sleep, go back. You'd have to go back to work.
What time you start work? 6 o'clock or something?
No, it's all 8 hours. Then it is 8 hours. 8 in the morning, work till 5.
Uh-huh. 8 till 5, and then you take your Model A.
Oh,
yeah,
and
drive
then
you
come,
to town.
Yeah, come to town and eat and clean
and
up.
Chase,
you know,
and go off and
yeah,
chase
and go
the ladies.
Goof around, you know.
Uh-huh. You remember any of those ones you're chasing after those days?
Oh, that's a long time ago. Yeah.
Must have been some nice ladies to keep you going till midnight and you only get 3 or 4 hours sleep.
Oh, I wasn't the only one. A lot of competition.
There was another story about the same time. I guess it must have been after or before you were working there, but You're talking about taking some horses over with this guy, going over the mountain, taking some...
Oh, were, yeah. That was... We were trapping that thing. We were packing our stuff, and is that it, me and another guy?
Yeah.
Is that, that must be what, yeah, about. We...
No, you got that one.
You got that one? Okay.
Okay. Good enough.
Okay.
We, of course, one of, there were four service horses, see? And this guy that worked for the something like that maybe might be a good idea to kind of leave out there whose horses they belong to, see, because they were government horses, but nobody paid no attention them days. And the, this guy that I was with, he was the packer. He packed for the Forest Service. He, all summer, he had this string. See, they had these crews all over, and he took the supplies to them. And when they got done, they got, after the fire season, when it started to rain, you know, well, they didn't, they'd lay off the crew, see, most of them, well, see, building a trail in a new part of the country. See, they're pretty wild country. They're building these fire trails all over, and they were out there quite a ways. And so they, like this particular time, these horses, there's about a dozen of them, I'd say, I don't know, 10 or 12 or something like that. They took them up on this meadow above Timberline. Is all this pea vine vetch, they call it. And they'd leave the horses and they'd feed on. They didn't have to take care of them at all. They just stay right there. And they get just as big and fat, you know, it's a good feed. And there's all deer in there and everything was in there right amongst them, you know. Well, this particular trip we made, anyway, the forest ranger, he lived... We live right next to him, had this forest ranger station, and he was a real good guy, you know, and this young fella, he's 2 years older than me, and he was packing for the Forest Service, see, and they were out about from this town, they'd bring them in Marble Mountain, then they'd keep them there during the winter, see, they'd, they'd put them out on bid, people would bid on them to feed them, $2 a month or $3 a month, per horse, see, and you had to take care of them. And well, if you had a good winter, you just turned them out in the grass, you know. And they fed, but if it got snow or tough, you had to feed them hay, you know. You had to take care of them. Well, he said them horses was about 25, about 35, 40 miles from town they were. And he said, "You guys," he told this guy, he said, "You guys bring the horses out." He said, "You can use them to pack your stuff in. We got to trap that winter," mean this other guy. "You can take your stuff out, use the horses, and bring them out." So that was fine, you know, because we were back in there about 30 miles, too, and we had different creeks we went on. We brought the horses in, and we packed them in... to this Diablo, the city of Seattle had a dam there, Diablo Dam. You probably heard of it. That was the last outpost there. And then from there on is all trails. They had a railroad that far. And we took our stuff up there, and he said, "You guys can use the horses." He said, "Go up on a mountain, bring them in, and pack your stuff, and then bring them into Marble Mount." That was another 30 miles in after we come in. So that's where we went up, and it was... I don't know, around October, later, and it had been snowing up high, you know, and we, some of them passes, we just barely got through, you know, with the horses. But then when you'd get down in a valley, there, it was bare ground, you know, but when you got up high, was a lot of snow, quite a bit of snow. Horses barely make it through, you know, but just
right up to the
just
top.
On, yeah, just on the divide, just make it through, you know.
How much snow does it take to stop a horse?
Oh, we had about, I'd say, 3-4 feet. We went across this one pass. It must have been that. And this guy, I was coming behind. We had about 5-6 mules and horses, and I was riding a horse. And he had another, he was ahead breaking the trail. But he had a big, I remember that big iron gray, and it was a real good horse. And that damn horse, he just plunged right through, you know. And we just made it, you know. We had to go about 3 miles across this divide from a creek called Little Beaver into Big Beaver. And then when we hit Big Beaver, we went down to the Skagit River. When we hit the when we got across that pass, we got in a valley at Big Beaver. There was no snow at all. It was just no snow at all, just bare ground.
How much weight can you put on a horse?
Well, they figure, you know, all you can put, all depends on the size of the horse. But they used to figure like the Foresters are about 200, 250, you know, a good pack. But then a lot of them guys have put more, you know, them packers that was packing for by the pound, you know, they'd load them down pretty good, you know. But that used to be about the average, 200, 250, you know, somewhere. And they'd put 300. A big horse could handle it easy, you know, but that's pretty, when you got beyond that, you was getting a, but then if you had a smaller horse, you know, you had, you cut down on a weight.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that's a good one. Maybe I'll put that in. Let's see, where were we right here?
But we just barely made it through, you know, the snow. But it was only about 2.5-3 miles. It wasn't too far, you know. And he was, like I told you, breaking the trail, and I was behind riding the horse, and I was blazing the trees, you know. We was going to set traps across, so when we come back, you know, I had an axe, and I was riding a horse, too. And I had a double-bitted axe and blazing the trees, you know. And when we come back, about 3 weeks later, or I don't know, or a month, I don't know, it is early to come back, you could just see about that much of the blazes. It snowed that much. Oh, it had come down some, in 24 hours, there'd be snow that deep, you know. And then it rained a lot. See, it rained sometimes a lot. And then it settled down. And then that's the way it kept. But right up in the up in that country, in them high divide, in by the time breakup would come, you know, it's like there'd be 10, 12, 15 feet of snow was nothing, you know. Huh. Well, you know what it is around Stevens Pass and that in Washington. Well, it's the same country in the same range, Cascade Range. You know?
Yeah. I've been right up around that same area you're talking about.
Yeah.
Right in there.
A lot of snow in there.
Yeah, a lot of snow. Mm.
Lots of snow.
We could only stay. You used to play rummy for 10
We used to play rummy. You know how you play rummy? There'd be 7, 8, or 10 around the table, and we'd play it for 10 cents a hand. You know, and who's got the best hand? You know how to play rummy, you know. You'd lay your hand down, well, who'd win? Well, if there's 7 guys, you got 70 cents or who was ever playing. And between me and my brother and this Italian, and he was a gambler. He's pretty good. You know, most of them guys, he liked to gamble, you know. And he knew how to gamble, too. He didn't have no money either. Like, we had a few bucks, you know, between us. And so I'd maybe play, step in and play, you know. If my luck was running good, I'd play till my ruck run out, you know, and then I went the other way, you know. Then my brother would step in, you know, or something like that, you know. And then he'd play, and if he didn't have any luck, or if, then this Julio was his first name. I can't remember his last name. Julio, he'd step in there then, you know. And between the three of us, somebody would be lucky. And we was living off that pan game, you know, that rummy game. In the Italian, he could play, and he'd win just about. He was sharp. And this guy that we had the cabin rented from upstairs, he was a bootlegger, and he sold booze down there. Oh, I don't know, a couple of dollars a pint or something like that, you know. And he liked to drink, this Italian, but he could handle his booze, you know. When he'd make a winning, he'd go down there and buy a pint and bring it up. Of course, we'd have a few drinks. Well, they were all bootleg dives all around there, you know. And the fishing was the big deal in Anchorage at that time. The fishermen would come in there, you know, from Bissell Bay and all over. And also the Alaska Railroad, you know, they hired lots of hands, you know, and tie hackers and all that, you know. And Anchorage got quite a run, you know, and it was a wide open town, you know, there were girls all over in the hotels, and it was a wide open town, you know, they didn't bother nobody.
Great place, huh?
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, the fishermen, trappers, and tie hanger.
Anyway, we got acquainted.
What was that first guy's name? Something Henrich?
Harry Ginrich.
Have you guys been around the Steele Hotel when Jim Crowder run it, as any of you guys?
Yeah,
well, remember the bald-headed guy, Ginrich? He run the hotel in the kind of a slim, bald-headed guy. That was this Harry's brother. What was his first name now? I knew him. Let's see. But anyway, this guy that's in the Steele Hotel, his brother was a hard, he come up here first, and then this other guy come up, and he worked around Fairbanks. He had a couple of brothers come up later. But this one guy that was in the Steele Hotel, he was a brother, this Harry, that we walked to Livengood in, him and this Charlie Baker. And when we got to Livengood, there was a lot of work around there, mines, but it was dry that summer. There was no water, and everything was shut down, you know. Nobody, and a lot of guys around there, but all their credit was good. They could go to the store, you know, and get anything they wanted when the mines opened up and they went to work, they paid it. See, that was no problem them days. Well, we got there, and we walked over, me and Harry and this Charlie Baker. Well, when we got there, there was nothing. We hung around there, and I was pretty well acquainted because I was there that spring. See, these guys wasn't, but hell of a good bunch of people around living. And we goofed around a while, so this Charlie Baker, he wanted to go in the hills prospect, you know. So he said, let's go out in the hills. Well, he was a hard rock. I said, I don't know nothing about hard rock. In fact, I didn't know a hell of a lot about placer either. You know, like I said, it worked all summer. We didn't make no money. Well, that was one of them deals, you know. Well, anyway, he said, what about the sawtooth? I said, well, I knew that country. See, I was in there all winter, trapped in there. Me and my brother did. We knew that country good. And I said, all right, let's go. I knew where all the cabins were and trails and everything. You know, I was pretty well on my toes then. So we walked, we was just going to go to the sawtooth, see, and goof around there. He thought that'd be a good place. We got to the sawtooth. We had there was an old cabin there on Buckeye Creek. We stayed there. And I said, well, let's go over to Quail Creek. That's 10 miles from here. Red Anderson and Eddie Farrell and Jack Elliott and Ivan Olson are mining there. I said, let's go over there. Well, that was just a hop them days, 10 miles. You know, Christ, I was only 20 years old. I could make that or nothing flat. And he was older, but he was, you know, he was about in his 30s somewhere, you know, young guy, you know. We went over there anyway, and we got over there, and those guys was mining, and we stayed there overnight, and they said, what are you going to do? And those guys said to it, you know, we'll stay there with him. So, well, we don't know what we're going to do. And Charlie said, I've been over to the head of the Hoot that winter, you know. He said, let's go over to the I'd been telling him about the Hoot Lanana, you know. He said, let's go over to the Hoot. I said, okay. So we took over to the Hoot Lanana. There's another head of Caribou Creek. There was another cabin. There's a good cabin there. And we went over there, looking around, you know. And so when we got there, I said, now the hot springs is another 8 miles from here. I was down to the hot springs. Me and this American Creek Shorty was down there that winter. And that was as far as I was down this way. So I said, let's go to the hot springs. All right. So we went down to the hot springs, you know. And there was a real good cabin there. An old guy, Pete Johnson, built a cabin there years ago. And did you meet this Louis Johnson, that mine? Well, that was his uncle, built a cabin. He was trapping there in a winter. Well, anyway, we got there and he said, well, let's go to, there was a good trail, you know, trapping trail. And I said, I knew how far it was to Man, you know, about 35 miles from there, something like that. And I said, I ain't been down this far, but I know Eureka's only about 10 miles from there. I said, let's go there and down to Eureka. So, all right, we didn't care where you're going, you know, anyway. So we took off and we went down the trail, and we get to just about where the bridge is, across the Hoot there, and here comes a guy out of the brush. you know, he walks out of the brush. He was fishing up the creek, and he hit the trail, and he's going back to Eureka. And he never looked up the trail, you know. He just took off down to Eureka. So me and this guy, we see him, so we put on steam. We knew he was getting close to Eureka. So caught up with him, and I was in the lead, and got up to him and said, "Hey," you know, he let out a war whoop. He jumped around. All day. He said, "I didn't think there was anybody within 50 miles of us." So this guy's name was Art Kruger, and he was working for, you know, Jones, right across from, you know, right where now where Jules Wright and those guys are camped, got their stuff. He was right up on the hill. They were working there. And they were shut down. There was no water. He was working for this guy. So he said, we said, "How far is it to Eureka?" Oh, he said, he told us, he said, 4 or 5 miles, 3 or 4 miles or whatever it was, something like that. And he said, "Where are you going?" We said, "Well, we're hitting, we don't know any place in particular, but we're going, headed for Miami." He said, "Well, come on with me to Eureka," he said. "I'm staying in this old roadhouse." The guy by Frank Stevens had an old roadhouse there, and he died a year or two before that. And he said, "You can stay with me." So we went over there, and we moved in, and we stayed there with him a few days. He had all kinds of, we had some grub and that too, you know, we was packing a little bit. Nothing, when we had to eat his grub, but one of them did. So he took us all around and showed us the mines, you know. He's a pretty nice old guy, you know. And anyway, we hung around there a few days. In fact, we went up on Eureka Creek. A guy by the name of Ed Warshbacher had the creek, and we was get a snipe there. We set up a rocker. Guy give us a rocker, Eric Bergman. And, oh, we made a couple of dollars, you know, we goofing around, rocking. So we just said, "Oh, the hell with it, we're going to come down to Manly." So we walked into Manly, and that's how we landed here. And then we hung around here, and then this American Creek, later he got the name American Creek Short, he was winting on a dredge there, and he stayed there for 2-3 years, and he walked over from Rampart, and here I was here. And I showed you that old roadhouse, that Pioneer Roadhouse, remember, in that... And he stayed there with us, the three of us. So him and this baker, they decided they got American Creek was starting to do some work. So they decided they'd go to American Creek and see if they could get a job. They walked over there, and they went over there, and they got a job. And I stayed in town, and I went fishing with Ira Wiesner up the river here. I worked around town there. I worked for Tim Worley first on the Fox Farm there, you know, and helped him there, and he paid me and everything. And then I went fishing, and then Charlie Baker, he quit before the season is over, and he went to Fairbanks, and Shorty stayed there, and he stayed there for 2-3 years after that. He'd watch the dredge in the winter, you know, and they had to have somebody there for overflow and stuff like that. And then in the summer, he was a winchman, and then he quit there, and from there he went over working up on the Yukon there, Coal Creek.
That's how you got in here.
Huh?
All right, let's see.
That's how you got here to Manly, huh?
Yeah, that's the way that I never got out of here.
Oh, jeez. Let's see.
$1,000, and that was the deal. They had a deal. No papers or nothing. Right there.
So which ground was this for?
Huh?
Which ground?
And that's in the Glen Gulch there. Yeah.
Okay, let's see if I got that story right.
No, it wasn't Shirley. You know, see, I got ahead. I can come up with the guy's name. It wasn't Shirley. I got Shirley Barr was up where we mined up there. It wasn't Shirley. Glenn. Got my name of Glenn. Lou Byers got his ground up there now, you know, Glenn.
His guy first name was Glenn or last
Glenn.
Name?
That's all I know, Glenn.
His first name? Last name.
No, let's see. No. Now, wait a minute. I'm getting... I know what the... Shirley. Shirley has Shirley Barr, Glenn Gulch. Was his name Glenn? I'm kind of mixed up on that. I can't remember now for sure. Been 2 or 3 of them guys, I kind of get, then I think a little bit. Well, anyway, he bought it off this guy and paid him cash, you know.
Okay.
And then he worked it that summer, and the ground was real good. This guy was working it too. He didn't know how good it was. This old Johnny Wheel told me that, and he made his $40,000 back. He was supposed to, and he got his money back, and he made $40,000. You know.
Well, why don't you turn it on for this thing right here?
It is on.
Oh, it is on. Okay.
What the heck was his name? Damn, I get that Shirley and Glenn mixed up.
So who mined it then?
Well, there were three, four different guys. Frank Manley was on it.
Well, Manley owned it.
Yeah, he owned it. But he didn't stake it. He was not the original staker.
But I mean, he didn't go out there and shovel dirt either. Who is the guy who is actually mining it?
Huh?
Manley didn't go out there and actually mine
it. No, he didn't mine it. He was a...
So he just hired...
Yeah, he would own the ground, but he'd hire help, you know.
He'd pay him wages then.
Huh?
He'd hire guys and pay
him
wages.
Oh, yeah, that's the way he used to...
Well, what I got in here is... he's talking about Manley, and then he goes, he was a plunger.
Yeah, he was, you know.
If it looked good to him, he went for it. I know one guy said when Manley bought Glen Creek in Eureka, he rode his horse out to the creek to see it. He asked the guy how much he wanted for it, then pulled $30,000 or $40,000 out of his saddlebags right on the spot.
Yeah, well, that was it.
No papers.
Old Johnny Wheel was right there. And
who was there, Johnny?
Johnny Wheel was the guy who told me about it, you know. He was an old hand around here. You know, those Wheels and Ramparts?
Yeah.
Those kids that are his offsprings, and Johnny Wheel. Got to tell you that story on that, of course. I don't know if you want to put it in your book or that, but this,
well, let
this
me
Lottie.
Wait, let me see if I got it in here.
Yeah?
Maybe I already got it in here.
Read that. Maybe okay. I told you that. Did I? In her and this other gal, you know, this Sarah Albert, did you meet her? Jimmy and Sarah was fishing down there, you know, and they started started down there, and they're beard up, you know. I don't know if you want to put that in your
about
being
matter.
Too good. You can,
it doesn't matter.
But anyway, no, Sarah started, they both had canoes. Sarah started ahead and she made it down to the camp. And Lottie was still sucking on a bottle, you know, and she was living with a guy by the name of Frank Haynes. He's a white guy down there. Well, anyway, she got caught down at Lottie's Point. A big rain come up, my brother. I guess it was just a pouring down, you know. And she was all beard up. And she did. She had this bottle, and she had $7, I guess, change. Anyway, there's a lot of silver around here then. And so she's all beard up. She tipped over, but she was close to shore. She got on the other side, you know, by Jerry Hooks there on that side there. She got there, and so she come up, and there was an old cabin right where I'm living, and my brother was staying there. And anyway, he said, Jesus Christ, you're about 11 o'clock. Somebody's pounding on the door, and who hollered, who, it's Lottie. What the? And he said, just down it like a rat, you know. She come up through the brush, you know. She said, can I stay here? Sure. He said, there's another bed crawling in the bed. And of course, they're all wet and everything. And we all had two, three beds in that cabin, different guys. They're peeled off and crawled in bed, of course. And so the next day, cleared, the storm was over and just as nice, and he had this inboard motor, and she had one of them little rattan canoes, you know. And she said, take me down there, will you take me down there, I gotta find my canoe. And she said, I had a bottle of 7 crown or whatever it was, anyway, and 7 silver dollars. And he just said, forget about he said, forget about that. She said, I know why I tipped over. It was then funny. And of course, he just laughed that off. And he said, it was, he said, you're, you know, and she said, well, I'll tell you where to slow up, you know. He got this old inboard, just cut it right down. He said, she's out at the deck. Just like, he said, it was so damn funny, you couldn't believe it. And she stopped. And he said, he threw it in reverse and stopped. And here, look, here's that bottle of booze. Of course, they fished out the bottle. They couldn't find the $7, though, he said. But she knew right where that booze was. You couldn't hardly believe that, you know. So he took her down the river then to the camp and come back. And, of course, that's where it got the name, then Lottie's Point. Everybody named it right around there.
Well, how deep was that water?
Well, she was right close to the beach there, deep, kind of deep there, but I guess she was right by the shore there. And
you could,
couldn't have been in very deep water to see it, you know. And it was pretty clear around there, you know.
They had to jump all the way in to get it out.
Huh?
They had to jump all the way in to get it out, huh?
No, I don't. Evidently, it must have been right close to the beach. It reached right in there and picked it up. I guess she was right, probably trying to make the beach or something, you know, when she flipped over. You know, drunked up and all that rain of pouring down. And yeah. Oh, she was quite a character, that one, too, you know.
Where was she from? She's from Tanana?
Yeah, I think she was raised. She's up and down the river. I think she was raised around Tanana there, someplace in there.
What was her last name?
Well, she lived with another Indian here. They wasn't married. And his name was Charlie Justin. And she went under that name for a long time. But then her nickname was Monkey Lottie, they used to call. I don't know where the hell she got that name. That was her nickname. You know, I never spend much time down there. You know what I mean? Just spend a couple of days or something, go down there, and that's about it. Through there, never spend no time.
Well, in 1933, was it more built up than Manly, or was it about the same
size? It almost was a pretty big, camp, you know. Quite a few people around there. It was mostly natives, you know. There was whites in there, not too many, you know. Of course, the hospital was there, you know. They're working in there, and then there's quite trappers, you know, too. There's quite a few white trappers used to make that their headquarters, you know. But there'd be probably 50, quite a few natives to one white man, you know. There wasn't many white. They'd come in during the summer. A lot of them would spend their summer there. The trappers, you know, would be scattered around.
So, like, Manly was pretty much the only white town around there.
Well, Manly was strictly white, you'd say. There was a lot of natives live up and down the river, you know. There's all up and down. Crossjacket was a big village. Baker Creek, there'd be four or five families and up, and they'd be down at the mouth of the slough and around there. But there was a... None of them actually lived in town. None of them lived in town. There was one or two of them, like that Lottie and Jesse. Jesse married to this Luke Isaacs in Westerland. And there's only a couple of girls around here, you know. That's all. Very few. They didn't in here, you know. But nobody. They didn't live here, you know. They lived out on the rivers.
Did people visit more between Rampart and here?
Well, no, there was nothing between, none of them between here and Rampart. The only one there between here and Rampart was this Lottie that when she lived at Baker Creek and out Eureka with this guy Frank Haynes, you know. That's all. There was nobody. Oh, there might be a few of them, maybe my guys maybe come from Rampart or someplace, worked in a mine, you know, just for the summer, you know, like Art, there's a Mayo here, Arthur, Yeah, Art Mayo, he used to work out your Eureka for Earl Francis. There are a few years and a few of them, you know, but they never lived here, you know what I mean. They'd get done in the spring, summer, they'd go back to Rampart. Or
okay, this is one of what that moose looked like again. So hair was standing up on the back.
Oh, yeah, you know how it stands up on the shoulders, you know.
Nose is flaring out.
He was just running up and down, you know, and them dogs is all trying to get at him, you know.
When moose do that, do they stomp down in the ice?
Well, no, he was just running back and forth. He was just running back and forth, you know, this moose, you know. And he was, I'd say, like you say, about 50 feet from the sled, you know. And I was on the other side, you know, for the, you know, timber, you know, could crawl a tree.
He still had his horns then?
No, he didn't. He didn't have no horns, and you could see.
So he wasn't putting his head down.
No, they shed their horns in about January, you know. Later part of January, they started dropping their horns, you know. And that was about in February, later part of February, sometime in March probably, when I was trapping beaver then.
Okay.
So then I got nerve enough. I went around, and he was staying on one side, and I had my rifle in his sled. Well, I had to do something. I thought he was going to get in them dogs, you know, and stamp them, you know, and... So I got nerve enough, I made a beeline for the sled, and I got my rifle out. When I got the rifle, I didn't want them, you know. I had from fall, I had plenty of moose meat. I wouldn't shoot them unless I had to. And I fired a couple of rounds at him, not at him, just close to him to scare him off. And he just shake his head, and all at once he whipped around, you know, after about the second round I fired. He took off, and he went up the creek just like mad, and that's the last I've seen of him, of course. that was odd, you know, how he, and that was about a 2-year-old cow, you know, was right in the creek pulling willows down, you know, how they hang over the bank, or the bank gave down, and he was up. I didn't even see him up on the bank until that cow took off, and the dogs, of course, I was running behind, like you had mentioned, there, you know. And they got away from me, see, and I knew they wouldn't go far because they never leave me, them dogs, you know. And I had a beaver house right around just a little ways, and they were laying, and that bull come out of the brush. That was odd. You know, the way it happened.
That bull and cow must have been hanging out together.
Yeah, evidently, you know, and he was up on the bank, and cow was on a... You know, in a rutting season, you never know what the heck they're going to do, you know, especially the bulls, you know, they make some noise, you know, and they'll come, you know, they'll come to you, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Talk to God, you know. Uh-huh. Well, see what happened there on that. Bill left. He was working on some rigging there, you know, and machinery there, and... He went up to, they had this property yet on Indian River, up in Akiakook, and he went up there to do something, I don't know what it was, just a few days. And when he come back, he was in town, you see, and he come to Manly, and I was working for a while for old McGee. And we picked him up in town here. McGee did with his car, and we took him to this camp. And it was kind of in the fall of the year. It's getting dark already, you know, about 10 o'clock at night. It's pretty dusky, you know. Well, he'd been gone from the mess hall for 2-3 days, I think he was up there. Well, McGee, we left him right at that little cabin alongside the road, you know, that Greg Gall uses for his trapping cabin. And we turned around, and we went back to the camp, to McGee's camp, where it's at now, you know, the big camp there. Well, the next day, early in the morning, me and McGee, we went, he had some property on Porcupine Creek in Circle Country, you know, at a Miller House, Porcupine Creek. And we went out there to pick up some stuff. We had two trucks. I drove one, he drove the other. And Dixie was a little girl. She was staying here with Judy Woods or something. I picked her up and took her with us, you know. We went there one day to mail her house, and we loaded up this stuff in a day or two. And when we got back, in the meantime, that night, Bill stayed in that cabin. Next morning, he went over to the cook shack where the bear been in there, raised in hell, you know. And he starts cleaning up the mess, and that's when the bear come back again, and that's when he got him, you know. And we didn't even know Bill was killed till we come back, and we got to live and good. And in the meantime, there's a lot. It rained and washed out all the roads and everything around here, you know. And we got stuck in live and good. We had to stay there overnight and come over the radio that bear killed Bill Strandberg. That's when we first got it, mean. So we, next day, the road to Hootlataqua was washed out where the road commission state went in. They fixed it, and we got the Eureka, and all that was washed out from around, the bend in there, you know, by McMillan. That's all washed out. Well, we had to stay there overnight, sleep in a pickup, till they come from this end and fix the road. Then we come into Manly. That's when Bill got killed that time. That's that year all them bears was around, you know.
What did it turn out? How'd that happen? He just, the bear jumped him when he was in
The bear was in the mess hall while he was gone, you know, ripping things up. Well, and Bill went there the next morning. He was cleaning it up, see? You know, cleaning up the mess. Well, while he was cleaning it up, the bear come back. And that's when the bear got him. He didn't, if he'd had a rifle or something with him there, which he should have, you know, had, you know, but he didn't.
Okay, that's too bad.
There's Phil Kozlowski and Teddy Luke from Tananaw, they were working for McGee, you know, and Harold went over there and found them. The brother Harold had to walk. Blowback was washed out, and he found Bill, you know, killed, you know, so he come to McGee's camp and told them guys. So Harold, Phil Kozlowski and Teddy Luke went back there, and they both took, I had my 270 there, and one of them had a 30-06, so when they went back there to where Bill was killed, you know, of course he was all dead and everything, but they figured the bear might come back, and the bear did come back. Well, they shot the bear. The bear come back again, you know, he was eating off of them, the bear. Yeah, that's a bummer there.
Yeah. Boy. Anyway.
In this country.
Yeah.
Your muck and everything was down low, and there wasn't too much gravel, and they didn't take nothing extra. They just take that gravel, just take the pay. You know, a lot of them drifts, they'd be right on their hands and knees shoveling. They're pretty rough.
Right on their hands and knees?
Oh, yeah. They'd get right down there digging in there, you know.
So then
they didn't take any more than they had to, you know.
How far would they follow? They'd follow that streak till it ended, I suppose, too.
Huh?
They'd follow that pay streak till it ended,
I suppose. Oh, yeah. You'd follow that, you know. You'd keep panning all the time. You know, if you drove some points, you know, and you didn't pan good, well, you know, there was nothing there. If there was no money, you didn't take it. You'd go one way or the other, swing off. You know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Follow the pay. You'd follow the pay streak, what they say.
So then, how long would one of those little tunnels that are on their hands and knees, how long would that go?
Oh, well, it all depends. They'd take a heck of an area, you know, they'd go in.
But you might have one of those tunnels saved from
Well, they only went so far from a shaft, you know, where you had the main shaft where you hoist. They'd just go so far back, and then they'd probably sink another shaft, see?
Oh, I see. So how far back would they go, maybe?
Yeah, well, it all depends, you know.
20, 30 feet?
Oh, no, they'd go further than that. They'd go
50, 60,
couple hundred feet, maybe 100 feet or more, you know.
Gee,
yeah.
Crawling on ways their hands and knees. Oh, yeah.
It was tough going them days, I'll tell you.
They couldn't even stand up for 100 feet.
No, they'd be hunched over in there, picking and shoving in the wheelbarrows and going to... And you had to work, and some of them... And this is no bull. You had to put so many wheelbarrows out a day, too.
They would...
You just had to take your turn, you know. You didn't sit around and take 2-3 wheelbarrows and let John do the work. He was right behind, and they'd have guys, they called them, and this is no lie. They used to have, they were just like, they had guys, they called them leaders. And they were some big, husky, bull-hunker Swede, you know, that could outwork about 3 ordinary guys. And you'd have to keep up with them. And he got 2 bits a day more, 4 bits a day more. And all these other birds would have to try to keep up with that bird. That's no fact. That's no lie. You just, well, there ain't anybody around you hardly that can. I know. I was still here when that was happening.
Huh. So what's the air like when you're down there?
Huh?
What's the air like?
Is it hard? Well, it was all right, you know, if it got, you got too deep or too far away, you know, they'd go by candles, you know, the old candle, that's what they used to test the ground, you know, how the light will go, no light, you know, no oxygen, you know, from a candle. Well, they'd probably dig another shaft.
So when a candle goes out, they turn around and head back. And
that was in my time, even. I was on the tail end of it, you know. But the guys telling me, you know, that was still fairly young guys, you know, in their 50s, they'd come over in the early days, and, you know, and when over the Dawson and around here when the campus first hit that.
Well, how do you swing a pick when you're underground like that? How do you swing a pick in there?
You're just getting here, swinging it from the side, you know. Anyway, you didn't pick up a bub, you know. You're just from the side you're working. Anything just enough to get in there with a wheelbarrow, you know.
Must have been an awful lot of dust inside there, too.
Huh?
A lot of dust
inside. No. Underground like that where you're torn, there's no dust. No, it's a... There's no dust. It's all wet, you know. It's all the wet ground. Uh-huh. You'd come out, them point drivers, they'd come out of there. It looked like a drowned muskrat, you know. Mud and everything all over them. They'd be driving them points. And, of course, after they pulled the points out, you didn't have no steam or nothing then, you know. They shut the steam off, you know.
Was it hot down there?
Well, while you was working, but after the, I know you're talking about, no, it never was hot, you know, it's cold down there all the time.
Even course, with what, the steam going
in? Well, when points? You, with the steam, well, it was a little warmer, you know, the steam was blown back from your points and everything, you know, and then all that steam blown back and the roof, you know, was sweating, you know, and the mud was coming down. And you ought to see them point drivers come out of there.
Well, when they would pan to check if they were still on the street, did they pan inside a cabin or something?
Oh, yeah, they'd pan right. They'd pan a lot. They'd take tubs of water and pan down there. Or either they'd pan when they had your bucket, see, and you'd hoist up. And they'd you'd bring out a load, you know, to dump. On a dump, you know, they'd stop, you know, and the guy'd go there with a pan and take a pan, you know, and he'd be panning in a boiler house. He had a boiler house, a log cabin or whatever you had, or a frame building, and your boiler was in there, you know. And they'd pan there, see, and then, see, panning good. Well, they just kept on going. And then they'd pan down in a hole, too. Of course, when you'd pull the points out, when you got through steam and you pulled the points out, it was dry. You know what I mean? But we were a little water, maybe, or something, leaking off the roof, but not a heck of a lot.
You ever in one of those holes when that water started coming into it?
Huh?
Were you ever down a mine shaft when water started
The only time I ever worked underground was that one summer. That first summer in Rampart, you know, I told you, me and my brother, we made $85 after working all summer when we got done.
Okay. So when you're picking, like, oh, well.
Geez, I imagine, you know.
I mean, like, their shoulders especially, or their legs or something? Or?
See, you like these taws, you just take so much, you know. You know how long to steam it. And you just take what was thawed, and the rest would be froze. All around you, the sides or the ceiling, it'd be froze. You know, you just take the tarred stuff, but they you know, you knew what we was taking. You know, you didn't go and take nothing, sir, that there was no money in, because you couldn't do it. It couldn't, you know, just wouldn't pay. You know, you had to take.
There's still enough room inside that drift, though, to run a wheelbarrow.
Oh yeah, you had to take enough. You know what I mean there, but they'd be like I'm talking to. You know, wheelbarrowing very high, but you still had to take enough that you could dig in there and shovel in a wheelbarrow. You know, and bring it back out, dump it in a bucket. You know, to hoist it out.
So they were usually kind of low and wide where they would.
Well, you know what the regular wheelbarrow is. That's what they use. You know, the regular.
Okay, good enough.
You know them, and he had a reputation. He could, and I don't know. They were several hundred pounds, six, seven, 800. He could pick one of them up. He was that strong. God, he was a skookum guy, and he died at a heart attack too. I guess I knew him pretty well. Good guy, too. He was a hell of a nice guy. He mined down here on Grand Creek below Tannenon late years. And his sister, Grace, she was a big wheel in a... What the hell was she up in Fairbanks there? Something with a commissionership up there. She was there for... She's dead now, too, the old hands. Part two, but I think when it was first hit... There were some guys, went up Baker Creek. They called them the Boston Boys. They was from back east of Boston. They come up and they hit Eureka first, Eureka Creek. They come in there. And then and then they were worked over from Rampart. They found there's four or five of them, and they tried to winter there that winter, what the old timers told me, and they found these guys, and they were scurvy and everything else, you know. And these guys that first hit Eureka.
Yeah, it turned on.
Yeah, that's what the old timers told me. And then I guess they come from Rampart. I guess he spread around here. You know, that's when Sullivan Creek was hit. You know, Toffee was in through there.
So Eureka was first.
Yeah, Eureka was first, yeah. Sullivan. Rampart was the first of them.
Yeah.
First hit, and yeah. He spreading out all around there, you know.
So who were the Boston Boys?
Well, that was this bunch, four or five guys. There was guys that come here from back in Boston, I guess. That's where that, and they were like everybody else, prospectors, you know. They're going to make it rich, and they hit up these creeks, and they did find gold, you know, on Eureka Creek there. And that's what started, I just started that country in there.
So that would have been right about turn of the century?
Well, I don't know. That was about, I guess, 1905, something in there, you know.
Was that like Mayo and some of those?
Well, that was a different outfit, that Mayo and Harper and all them guys, you know. They were on mostly on the Yukon. They were up there in a 40-mile and all through that. And they were, a lot of them, they were kind of traders, you know, and that too, you know. Like old Cap Mayo and... And all them guys, and old Harper, and
how about
Evans, and huh?
How about the guy they named Bean Ridge after?
I don't know, huh? I hear two stories. They said there was a guy and his wife had a trading post down there early days, down around Cross Dag. Then I heard another guy told me, a old Cy Noble, he was the old packer. He told me, see, they used to go from here, they went right over... From the cemetery, see, they had a trail. Then they dropped into Tofty when they was in there. And they were going with horses and, well, mostly beans, you know, and stuff like that, you know, the old, and that's where packing beans, that's where it got the name, Bean Ridge. That's what he told me now. I don't know if he, Bean Ridge, going over the hill at the...
I like that one better.
Yeah,
that's a really yeah. And I think the guy was telling the truth. He was Rampart all over. He always had a string of mules, and he was a packer. Is what he was. He was a kid. He was a kid in the when this battle, Custer got wiped out. He was living. They was living just a little ways from there. He said, "Just a kid." He remembered that. He real old when he died. When I knew him, Cy Noble was his name. Hell of a guy. Drink booze. God, that guy can. He was part Indian too. He's some kind of part Sioux or something. He told me, he said he remembered that when he was a kid, they was all, they lived right in quite a ways from there. He said everybody was scared. They thought they were going to come and wipe them out, you know, when that after that battle, you know.
That was about 1870-something.
Yeah. And see, well, I knew him in the 30s, see, when I knew him, when I 34 and 35 and through there, long live and good, see. He must have been 100 years old, I guess, when he died, at least that, you know. Huh. He had pretty good memory, but boy, he could sure punish that snake. He had a roadhouse, too, at one time. You know, the log jam in Tullivanna? He had a roadhouse there for a number of years.
Huh. Let's see, where are we?
I don't tear a lot of them. I might wind up in San Quentin.
Well, you're talking about the scouts would be sent on out, and you guys went to, would go to some town or something. What town would you go where you'd get, be able to get some supplies and booze and get to bring them back? Was that just to the PX? You'd be able to go there and then bring it back to the other guys?
Well, we'd go and, like down in the island, see, we could move around. When all the excitement was kind of over down there, you know, and the Japs pulled out of Kiska and all them places, you know. Well, even before that, when they were, we could move around quite a bit, see. We were G2, you know, that's supposed to be intelligence, combat intelligence, see. We're supposed to be going on these islands and seeing if there's any Japs there. And we could get to Anchorage in that now and then, you know, on some deal, you know, we'd cook up, you know, and we'd bring a bunch of booze down there. And then we'd peddle it to them GIs. You could sell anything that had alcohol, you know what I mean. You'd buy a bottle of booze in Anchorage for $3-4 at that time. You take it down there and get 50. Them GIs would just stampede you, you know. There was no place to spend your money. There wasn't. There was, like them PX, they had nothing in them or nothing. Boy, a bottle of booze, you could name your price for that, you know. And that's why all them guys was making booze around in them. There's so many of them hillbillies, you know, in the army. They knew all about making moonshine, you know, and stuff like that. They'd get whatever thing, and anything had alcohol you could sell for 40, 50 bucks a 50, you know, and up to 100, you know.
Do they ever have any bum whiskey, any bum booze?
Oh, there was a lot of, they called it torpedo juice, you know, that they put in them torpedoes, you know, in the Navy. There was a lot of Navy down there, you know, and they'd steal that torpedo juice, you know, and they drank that, and they had something in it. Oh, it'd kill them, you know. It killed a lot of guys, you know, drinking it, you know. But then a lot of guys are smart. They knew how to distill it, you know. They'd cook it over again, distill it, you know, again, run it off again. And you just get the plain alcohol. See, they had all that stuff doped up so the Navy and the sailors and the GIs couldn't drink it. But they drank it anyway. They would. Oh, they killed a lot of them down, the guys. That's a fact. I know that.
They actually kept it inside torpedoes?
Yeah, they put that. That's to run the torpedoes, that alcohol, see?
Oh, that.
Yeah, that's it. And there were quite a bit of Navy down there, you know. But see, the Navy, there was a lot of Seabees down there, and then there was quite a bit of Navy too, you know, and it was all just everything down there, destroyers and all that, you know. And then like at ADAC now, there was a place called Finger Bay. And they, that was, they had a, it was a PT. They had these PT boats down there, squadrons. They had about 25, 30 of them down there. And they had all kinds of Seabees down there, you know. But they had beer in every, the Navy had beer in that all the time. But the Army didn't have no beer. The Army didn't have nothing. They had no beer. Seagulls, you know, they had their PXs and they could go there and when they would, then they could get all the beer they wanted, 10 cents a can or something like that. I don't know what it was. But then there was no, it was pretty rough down there. There's, you'd see the uniforms, sailors with half partly GI pants, you know, and were, that's the way, there was no, it was rough down there, no clothes, you know, no mat uniform. They don't care how you went down there, you know. And then these GIs, they'd get sailor a jacket or a hat, and they'd go right in them PXs, and they'd get their sailor, you know, get beer, you know, until they went down there and got all beered up, a bunch of them, one night from this 807 engineer, and they wiped out them Seabees down there. And then, of course, then they was all off limits, you know, you have to have a passer. Like that 297, you know, entry that you're talking about in all these miners and trappers and loggers and fishermen, you know, and they're pretty tough guys, you know. And, of course, the Ford Infantry, they'd go down there and they'd throw them all out of the PX. They'd get beared up. And then they'd put the 297 off infantry, off limits, see. And that's what they used to laugh about. They'd say the only battle the Ford Infantry, you know, had that good reputation in battles, you know. The only battle that 290, the Ford Infantry lost was with the 297. Yeah, they'd go down there and they'd... Oh, you down there, you know, down in there, all that stuff like a bottle of booze, you could just name your own price practically for it. They'd pay up to $100, you know, for a bottle of booze, you know. There was no place to spend your money for a long time. Then stuff started coming in the PX, you know, in poker game. Poker games going all the time. Finally, the money would all wind up, you know, with about a half a dozen guys that have all the money, you know. And then they'd have these big games. Oh, hell, I see one guy at Fairbank, I see one win $10,000 one night. Me and another guy with him, we won $1,000 a night one night.
What kind of pay were people getting then?
Well, when we first went down there, I went in at $21 a month, and when I went down many islands, I got 30. Then I got to be a corporal. I got $70 a month, and that was as high as I got. A private only got, private got 60 towards the last. You got that 10%. That was overseas, that was classified. You got 10% when you went down there, above, you know, regular pay you got.
Yeah, but still, $60 a month is only about $700 a year.
Yeah, that wasn't no money.
So $1,000 bucks in one night's a year and a half pay.
Yeah, that's it. You didn't get it. Well, down there, there's nothing you could buy. Then in the PXs, they started getting tobacco and all that stuff. You could, but when it first, like I said, that right down there, you couldn't even get a package of cigarettes. A package of Bull Durham or a cigar, and you'd stand in a line from here to the Manly, you know, to get that. Hmm. There's no tobacco or nothing down there.
Well, how many years were you in the Aleutians?
I was down there 23 months. I was down there. Oh, yeah, there's nothing. It's pretty. Like to me, it was nothing, you know, it didn't bother me, you know, a lot of us guys from here, but geez, them guys from them cities and back there, like from back in New York and all them places, Jesus, they thought they was at the end of the world in hell, you know, and well, it wasn't tough down there. Oh, it was wet, you know, and rainy and everything. You didn't get much to eat, poor grub and all that, but It didn't bother us guys, you know. It didn't bother me.
Yeah. Well, when you were there, do you remember there was a guy that was, they had some sort of a newspaper or something they're putting out, but there's this guy who's a writer, and he worked in Hollywood, and he wrote mystery stories and tough guy detective stories, and they made movies out of him and stuff like that. You ever hear of him being around there? Dashiell Hammett is his name. And he was on ADAC. I think it was ADAC. Yeah, middle of the war. And he was there for a while. Must have been there.
Well, there was a lot of those guys. Now, there was a guy who used to be in Fairbanks. He was an announcer on it before the war. George Nelson Myers. And he wrote for Yank. You know, uh-huh. Yank, that, uh-huh. Yeah. He was down there. And I knew him quite well. Nice to see him around Fairbanks after that. We used to talk about the islands and that, you know. And
well, there's I don't know what happened. Guys, you know, I just wondered.
Huh?
I just wondered.
I didn't know. And there was several of those reporters, you know, down there, you know.
Well, this guy was stationed there. He's just stationed there. Yeah. But he before he got in the Army, he was working in Hollywood.
I know there was one clown down there. He was for the Army. He was he was in the Army, but he was like a reporter. He could go do anything he wanted. He could any outfit he could go into and ration and do anything he wanted, because he was taking. He had a bunch of cameras hanging on him, you know, and taking pictures and that all the time. And boy, he was about as phony as a $3 bill, too, you know. Oh, he had a line, you know, and he'd go around and quite a promoter, you know. There was a lot of grub around them camps, you know, and stuff like that. Of course, that was for the officers. That wasn't for the plain dog face, you know. And he'd go there and he'd start smelling around the mess sergeant the first thing, you know. He'd get up to the good grub, you know, and he'd get these, he'd get his camera, well, here's it. Yeah, he was, you know, and he wasn't taking pictures of everybody, you know, and he'd tell this old mess sergeant, you know, and he'd give him a line and he'd get it, take your picture and I'm going to have you and this, all that. And Jesus, they went over for that, you know, and the old, and all he was doing, he didn't even have, he's clicking them, he didn't even have no film in the camera, and he was working him for some steaks and stuff like that, you know. I know there were two of my buddies was traveling with him there, and they said, they never had no film in there, he's in the lottery, they we'll get something to eat, I'll show y'all. That's what he was doing.
Oh,
geez. Oh, God.
There must have been lots of schemes going on.
Oh, God. We used to pull a lot of stuff, you know, take a lot of booze down there and peddle it, you know, and everything.
Well, let's see. Let me finish this guy up here.